This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Last week on this program, we talked about the cost of gasoline as prices at the pump continue to hover around $3 a gallon. Today, we focus on possible solutions to the problem. What can be done to bring down prices both in the short term and further down the line when the effects of new drilling, new refineries, or new technologies might begin to make a difference? What are the viable alternatives? When exactly might they become available? And at what expense to our pocketbooks and to the way we live our lives? In Congress yesterday, Senate leaders decided that a $100 gas rebate was not a good idea. But a raft of other proposals is under consideration in Congress and at the White House. Around the country, local governments and individual citizens are trying ideas of their own. Later in the program, say it ain't so, Captain America, Civil War in Marvel Comics. But first, the rising price of gas and what, if anything, can be done about it. As always, we welcome your calls. What do you want the government, auto manufacturers, and energy companies to do? How willing are you to change your own consumption habits? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. We begin with Jeff Tollefson, the reporter for Congressional Quarterly, who covers energy policy. He joins us here in Studio 3A. Nice to have you be in again, Jeff.
Thanks for having me, Neil.
Let's start with that defeated gas tax rebate. Ordinarily, you'd think the idea of giving back each American citizen $100 would be pretty popular. Not so.
Well, that proposal is actually still technically alive. What they've done is they've changed the way that they're going to propose it. Originally, they were looking at putting that, along with a package of other proposals, into the emergency supplemental bill for the war funding for Iraq and Afghanistan and hurricane relief. What they've done is they've backed off that and altered some of the proposals. And now it looks like what they're probably going to do is push the $100 rebate along with Arctic drilling. And that may hold together as a package. It may be broken off into different pieces.
Mm-hmm. What about the idea of the holiday 2 months on federal gas taxes, which are a little over $0.16 a gallon? Excuse me.
Well, all of these ideas are still floating around out there. Both parties are looking at the different proposals that would do this for different periods of time. The Democrats say that the Republicans aren't doing enough. The Republicans are still trying to figure out how they're going to push this and when they're going to push it, when they're going to bring it to the floor. So, nothing's quite dead yet. Everything's swirling around right now.
So what are the prospects that Congress is actually going to be able to move forward on legislation? Does the Republican leadership, for example, think it's vital to have something come out that addresses gas prices?
Well, that's the big question right now. And I'm not sure that we're going to know an answer for maybe a few weeks, maybe even longer. They're definitely trying to do something right away. But as it stands right now, the big legislation in the Senate, it includes Arctic drilling. It includes, the $100 rebate. And there's already been a lot of opposition to that, both among Republicans and Democrats and outside pundits.
People have figured out that $100 is two, maybe three fill-ups.
Right. And it doesn't do anything to solve the underlying problem, which is, an issue of supply and demand.
Mm-hmm.
But if they want to do this right away, their plan to bring it to the floor might require 60 votes. And, the Republicans have never been able to muster 60 votes on Arctic drilling.
And tacking it on with another provision that is not wildly popular or vital itself does not necessarily improve the prospects of the drilling part of it.
Right. So this faces a lot of challenges on a lot of fronts, and it's kind of a question of how the politics are going to play out. I mean, there's a lot of strategizing going on in the background right now, and both sides are trying to figure out, mainly the Republicans are trying to figure out, if they're going to lose a vote, they want to lose it in such a way that they can point at the Democrats and say they blocked us.
Mm-hmm. Again, wanting the issue, not necessarily legislation sometimes, but wasn't it just a year ago that Congress passed a monumental overhaul of the of energy policy?
Yeah, that's right. That was, an $85 billion energy policy bill, now law. And at the time, it was touted as a big accomplishment, and in some ways it was. It addresses, everything from renewables to fossil fuels and nuclear energy. But it didn't include, some of the big issues on either side, like Arctic drilling or fuel economy for the Democrats. And so now, you know, now you do see the Republicans backing off and saying, well, you know, we never thought this was going to solve all of our problems. We need to let that play out, and we need to take out some of the, you know, they're even talking about taking out some of the incentives that were in there for the fossil fuels industry.
Mm-hmm. And there were some, well, it was a rejiggering of how you calculate stockpiles. And, well, some of the energy companies weren't happy with that proposal in the Senate. And indeed, the majorities, the Senate, the Republican majorities pulled out of that.
Right. So this is this was an issue that's actually come up in different places. Most recently, it came up last week as part of the energy proposal put forward by Frist and the Republicans in the Senate. And that that proposal was quickly withdrawn on Monday after it hit big opposition, not only from the oil and gas industry, but it was going to go economy-wide. So it's hit a lot of opposition, and they have withdrawn that. So that's the first piece that they've pulled, and now it's a question of what's going to happen to the rest of it.
If you'd like to join our conversation, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And why don't we begin with Patrick. Patrick's calling us from Louisville, Kentucky.
Hello?
Hi, Patrick. You're on the air. Please go ahead.
Right. I've seen news reports about investigating price gouging by the oil companies. But I would like to see an investigation into the true cost of regulations for the production of oil and also the refining of oil. We've had hardly any refineries built in the last 30 years, and it seems like they're at an incredible cost disadvantage compared to older refineries because of this.
Is this those issues come up at all, Jeff Tollefson?
They certainly have. You know, there's a big debate about what to do with refineries right now. You know, and there have been numerous proposals put out there to streamline some of the regulations on new refineries and on, you know, expanding existing refineries.
Mm-hmm.
So far, I mean, the caller's right. So far as what's happened over the last 20 years is we've actually shut down a lot of the old refineries and expanded production at the refineries that we've maintained. So it's been about a net wash over the last 20 years.
In terms of refining capacity.
Right, right. So now the question is, you know, refiners are starting to put a bunch of new money in there because it's a profitable business right now. They're making record profits. So they are actually putting money into expanding current refineries. You know, the House passed legislation last year that would promote new refineries. But that, you know, pretty much landed with a thud in the Senate, largely because, you know, the industry has been kind of, you know, they haven't exactly come out and said that they want to build new refineries. If you talk to them, a lot of them will say we would rather expand current refineries because it's easier to do. It's, you know, it's tough to get a new refinery in, you know, both with local regulations and federal regulations.
And the environmental regulations are pretty stiff.
Yeah. And, you know, you've got the NIMBY issue, not in my backyard issue. I mean, nobody wants a new refinery next to them. So the question, I mean, the first hurdle you have to get over is where do you put it?
Patrick, thanks very much.
All right. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Let's go now to Zach. And Zach is with us from Portland in Oregon.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I just wanted to know why nobody's talking about gas prices doubling in the United States. We pay less than most industrialized nations do for their fuel, and it seems to me that that would slow the consumption rate down. And if you can make the choice of whether or not you want to fill up that truck if gas is at $5.50 a gallon.
So Jeff Tollefson, the oil that is purchased by Britain or France or any of the other countries that Zach is talking about costs about the same as the oil that we buy. The difference is the amount of tax they put on it. Is anybody talking about raising taxes on gasoline to reduce consumption?
Well, that idea has been out there for a long time, and a lot of economists and a lot of other experts believe that that would actually be a wise way to go, primarily because you raise the taxes, you raise the cost of fuel, and then you let consumers make the decision. Do they want to pay more and drive the same, or do they want to drive less?
I mean, it occurs to me, though, that economists don't run for re-election.
That's exactly right. And, you know, and so you can talk to economists today and even, you know, a lot of the market analysts, and they'll say, you know, that would be a wise thing to do. I mean, one idea is out there right now is to put a gas tax on that says if it drops below, you know, where it is now, well, then the gas tax kicks in to where you maintain it at this price.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, these aren't politicians, and on Capitol Hill, you know, the word tax is a tricky one.
Especially in an election year. Zach, thanks very much.
Thank you.
There's another idea back from the 70s and the Carter days that some people have talked about. In those days, the speed limits were reduced to 55 miles an hour for purposes of conservation. Anybody talking about bringing that back?
I haven't heard that one in the last week, although that one, I think it came up last fall. I mean, there are a lot of other things that you can do just in simple conservation. I mean, just inflating people's tires properly saves a certain amount of gas, and driving slower on the highways saves gas. And carpooling, you know, so all of these ideas are out there, and, you know, and I think some of the federal agencies, like the Department of Energy, if you check on their website, I'm sure somewhere they've got a list of all these measures that you can do.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, those aren't the kinds of flashy proposals that politicians are looking at or looking for right now.
Nor would they, as far as my reading of the issue goes, nor would they make a meaningful change in the price of oil.
That depends on who you talk to.
Really?
You know, a lot of people say that you can make, you got to look at the numbers. You could make some analysts think you can make a big, you know, a minor dent in the grand scheme, but a 2 or 3% drop in consumption due to conservation and carpooling on a national level, that's a big number.
Mm-hmm. If you believe that those sorts of things
If you believe that that'll work.
Yeah.
But, you know, and that's what you tend to see if the price of gas goes up. You know, already we're seeing, you know, drops in the rate of in the rate at which consumption is going up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not dropping altogether, but it has slowed. You know, the demand for new oil has slowed a little bit, or new gasoline has slowed a little bit in recent months.
So ultimately, if you can reduce demand, prices should fall a little bit.
Right. I mean, this is, you know, the basic law of supply and demand. You know, as prices go up, people react, and then prices come back down at some point. But you have to be patient.
Patience is one thing the American public is not celebrated for. But anyway, we'll hear more from them with their phone calls and their emails after a short break. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. We'll be back after the break. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We know gas prices are high and could be headed even higher. Is there anything we can do about it in the short term, in the longer term? If you'd like to join us, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. Our guest is Jeff Tollefson, a reporter with Congressional Quarterly who covers energy policy. And joining us now is Peter Terzakian. He's chief energy economist and a director of the ARC Financial Corporation. His new book is called 1,000 Barrels a Second, The Coming Oil Breakpoint and the Challenges Facing an Energy-Dependent World. He's with us from the studios of the CBC in Calgary. Nice of you to be with us today.
Thanks very much.
And one of the things you look at, not necessarily governmental policy so much, you look at the supply side and what's out there to be found. And, well, you know, the fact is back in the 70s, people worried a lot about, you know, no more oil to be found. And, well, they kept finding more. Is that the case today, do you think?
Well, there's no question more is being found. And going back to the 70s, of course, the big what I would call silver bullets back then were what was found in the North Sea and Prudhoe Bay in Alaska, which were very big discoveries that were brought online relatively quickly. Today, more oil is being found. That's not really the issue. The issue is bringing the oil to the market. And then there's also the issue the quality of the oil is not as good as it used to be. Today, oil is burdened by all sorts of political turmoil and geopolitical intrigue, which we see in places like Iran and Nigeria and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And so on top of being more riskier and costlier to find, it's just more difficult in general.
Well, for example, a few hundred miles north of you, the great Athabascan tar sands depot, billions of barrels of oil, we're told, locked up in there. But it's got to get pretty expensive before it's worth getting out.
Well, I think, yeah, you really have to understand what those tar sands are. They're oil mixed in with gooey sand and gravel, and it takes a lot of energy to liberate that oil and bring it to market. Very costly, and takes a long time to build the infrastructure. I mean, this, contrary to popular belief, it's not a savior by any stretch of the imagination.
And as you're talking about the difficulties of bringing the prices we always see quoted in oil per, you know, dollars per barrel is light, sweet crude, either, you know, Texas or Brent, if you're talking about the North Sea. But that isn't the majority of the supply.
Well, it depends where you are. I mean, in parts of the world where the oil is easy to bring out of the ground, that is like Saudi Arabia and places like that, the Middle East. But, you know, over there, the burden is not a geological burden. It's a geopolitical type of burden. In places where the oil is easier to get, like the tar sands, because it's heavier, but there is no geopolitical burden. So if it's not one thing, it's another.
None of it making a very pretty picture. You say that we're going to be hitting what you call the break point. What's that?
Well, the breakpoint is when we're going to have to ultimately recognize that this trend of increasing demand against a context of supply that's increasingly challenging, costlier, and riskier to bring to market is going to have to change. And the thing that's going to have to change this time in the absence of silver bullets is probably going to have to be lifestyle and consumption.
Lifestyle and consumption, unpopular subjects.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely unpopular. The reality is it's the lowest hanging fruit out there in terms of basically drive less, carpool, mass transit if you can. Unfortunately, these are choices that are difficult in the near term for people to grasp.
Mm-hmm. Let's get some more listeners involved in the conversation. And why don't we turn to, this will be Ron in Lodi, California.
Hi, good morning. Can you hear me? I have a little static.
Yes, we can hear you, Ron. Please go ahead.
Great. Why wouldn't it be a good idea to do what was done in World War II, and that is have gas rationing? The principle being that we're at war, it is said, and our government has actually been criticized for not making that point and asking people to sacrifice. People might go for it on a patriotic basis, so that would certainly reduce consumption drastically.
There was at least rationing on when you could buy gasoline back in the 70s. Joe Tollefson, is anybody in Congress contemplating anything like that?
No, I don't think that you know, the debate's gotten that extreme yet. I mean, you know, there are people calling for conservation measures, but you know, the fact of the matter is, you know, gas is at, you know, maybe $3 a barrel, but
$3 a gallon.
Or $3 a gallon, right, at the pump. But, you know, that's not enough to make any politician call for rationing. I mean, what they actually want to see is people be able to do what they want to do.
Mm-hmm.
That's the problem, letting people do what they wish to do and at the same time complaining that there isn't a solution. In World War II, it was not like in the 70s, as you might have read, that you had coupons and you could only buy so much gas.
Mm-hmm.
In a certain period of time.
And all those coupons were allocated based on what you did. If you were the country doctor, you got more. Worked in town, you got less.
Right.
All of that sort of thing.
It's a tough thing, but people might go for it. And the thing is, as long as we don't come up with solutions that are that require choice and make a little sacrifice, this thing is going to go on forever. But thank you very much.
Thanks, Ron, for your call. Appreciate it.
You bet.
In the wake of spiking gas prices, one community in South Texas got proactive. The governing board of Bee County, Texas, called for a boycott of ExxonMobil gas stations in their area. To tell us more about that, we turn to Adrienne Jackson, managing editor of the Beeville Bee-Picayune. She's with us by phone from her office in Beeville, Texas. Nice of you to be with us today.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Tell us a little bit more about this resolution. What exactly did the county government hope to accomplish?
The county government hoped to bring awareness of the rising costs of gas and to the public, and also to start a grassroots campaign in protest of the rising costs.
And why did they pick out ExxonMobil?
Because of the recent publicity about ExxonMobil, they've reported record profits. Their CEO retired recently, Mr. Raymond Lee, with a $400 retirement package, and the Bee County judge said that these are the stories that his constituents are bringing to him. He felt like this was his time to act on it.
Mm-hmm. Now, you work for the newspaper, of course, and I understand you visited some of the Exxon stations in the area. What did you find? Were people observing the boycott?
Yesterday, I went to all three of the local ExxonMobil stations, and they had a pretty steady stream of traffic. People were out there getting gas. They were coming in from Bee County, obviously. They were also coming in from Corpus Christi, San Antonio, all over the place, specifically to get gas at the pantry to let the family that owns the chain know that they support what they're doing and that they realize that while there's a there are some problems with gas and with the cost of gas, the local business owners can't be held responsible for that.
And of course, ExxonMobil doesn't own the gas station. They just
that's right.
Sell the gasoline.
Gas stations are independently owned.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about Bee County. How are gas prices affecting people's lives?
Well, Bee County and a lot of rural communities don't have access or ready access to public transportation. We do have a public transportation system here, but it's no way on the scale that it is in larger cities. So people here almost have to have a car. And so cars and gas are a daily part of daily life here. A lot of people don't live in the city proper. They live outside. They live in the county. I live in the county as well, and we have to commute 10, 15, 20 minutes, 50 minutes back and forth to work. We have some people here who travel an hour to and from work every day, so we really depend on our cars and our gas, and it does hurt our pockets when it goes up like this.
Well, some of us here in the Northeast would toss our hats in the air at only a 20-minute commute, but I wonder, there's been an email going around that calls for boycotts of ExxonMobil by a guy named Captain Boycott. This is based on allegedly the experience that happened in Argentina. Any connection between the effort in Bee County and that email?
Well, there are some similarities to our resolution in that email, but I'm not sure what the connection is to the email.
All right. Adrian Jackson, thanks very much. Appreciate
it. Thank
you. Adrian Jackson, managing editor of the Beeville Bee-Picayune, joined us by phone from her office in Beeville, Texas. And Peter Terzakian, can any community, whether it's Beeville or New York City, by themselves, would a boycott have any effect, do you think?
No, other than, you know, maybe locally it may affect the prices in the short term. The oil is a global commodity, even gasoline is a global commodity. I think people need to recognize that it is an uncomfortable time. People are wanting to point fingers and find blame, but this is a global issue. And there's so many externalities that are affecting the price of oil and hence the price of gasoline. There's, you know, political issues. Technological issues in bringing the oil to market. There's logistical issues in the supply chains and bringing it to the gas station, environmental issues, climatological issues like hurricanes. There's so many factors and variables that are going into this that just pointing fingers at one company, it may feel good, but it's not going to do much.
Email question from Derek. Are there any plans to overhaul the EPA's mile per gallon ratings? These are known as CAFE standards, by the way. I've heard many times that their ratings are unrealistic and do not give consumers a true reflection of how many miles per gallon a certain automobile has. Jeff Tollefson, Congress talking about CAFE standards, the fuel efficiency standards?
Yeah, that's a perennial debate on the Hill.
It's a perennial debate, but it hasn't changed since 1990.
Exactly. The Transportation Department actually sets those. Some lawmakers have been pushing for legislation that would do that, that would increase those standards for years. Last week, the administration requested that Congress give it the authority to not just increase the standards for passenger vehicles,
mm-hmm.
For passenger cars, rather, but also to reform the way they're calculated. So that's one thing that is in the Senate proposal, and the House is holding a hearing on that legislation this week. So that might be one thing that comes out of this. That proposal may well make it through both chambers, and then the administration would have the authority to reform the way that those are calculated and do something similar to what they did with light trucks and SUVs earlier this year.
Mm-hmm. Here's another email question. This is from Gene in Des Moines, Iowa. I don't hear about the low price of U.S. old oil. Oil wells that are of a certain age and older are capped at a low price for their product. How much is that cap? How much is produced from these wells? Can you help us out on that, Peter Terzakian?
I don't know, regionally what the specific caps are, but it does bring about a good point, which is that a lot of the oil that has been found historically is what can be termed cheap oil. The reason that companies like ExxonMobil and others are making big profits today is because they're selling the old oil, which was found cheaply at today's higher prices. The real question about oil profits is, what is the incremental new barrel of oil costing to bring to market? And that new barrel of oil is far more expensive to bring to market than those old ones. And so what you're going to see over the course of the next few years is that these big profits are not going to be as big as you think because, as I said, the technical and political challenges in bringing new oil to market are becoming much, much more costly and much riskier.
Let's talk with Kathy in St. Louis, Missouri.
Hi, I just wanted to make the comment, too, that, you know, I live in a metropolitan area where I have to commute into work 30 miles each way every day because there's no affordable housing in the city where my job is, and I couldn't find a job where we live. It's more suburban. So I think the issue of sprawl is something that kind of gets forgotten here when we talk about taxing or putting measures on our gas to lower demand by increasing the price, is that for people like me, that just really is not going to work and is not an option and will only make worse our issue.
Yeah, Peter Terzakian, entire communities built with no sidewalks. Everybody's expected to drive to work.
Oh,
these
excerpts. Yeah. This is the number one issue. You know, people point fingers at the oil companies. They point fingers at Detroit for the type of cars they make. But, you know, nobody's pointing fingers at the real estate industry for developing communities that are far-flung. And so what you now have is, that has emerged over the course of the last 15, 20 years is urban sprawl. And we have people like Adrian Jackson, whom you've interviewed in Beeville, Texas, where they're completely reliant on transportation vehicles. And there is no mass transit to help them out.
Kathy, thanks for the call.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. We're talking today about gas prices. What, if anything, can we do to bring them down? Short-term, long-term, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go to Don. Don with us from, where is this? It says Dallas, Oregon. Is that the Dales?
Dallas.
Dallas, go ahead.
It's like Texas, only it's not.
Okay.
Okay, yeah, I live in another one of these rural areas. We're close to Salem, south of Portland. There's no public transportation, and it seems as though we know that the oil companies are making windfall profits. Some of this money should be recouped and invested in light rail systems. We can't change the fact that millions of people live out in these areas and need a way to get to work. And also, when you think about the cost of the war in Iraq, I mean, has anyone calculated how much we're paying for fuel when I know the military is the biggest consumer? How much are taxpayers actually paying for fuel that goes to support the military?
Mm-hmm. There's that. And of course, also, Iraq is not much of a producer anymore.
no, but it was going to pay for itself, remember?
I do remember that. Jeff Tollison, let me ask you about that windfall profits tax. Is that an issue that politicians are talking about?
Yeah, it's been bantered around on the Hill, especially among Democrats in the last week and a half. It's a little unclear whether, you know, how far that's going to go. You know, they're still talking about it, but, you know, I don't know what the odds are that Congress would actually adopt anything like that. On the other hand, both Republicans and Democrats are now talking about repealing some of the tax incentives and subsidies that have been given to, you know, the fossil fuels industry, oil and gas. And, you know, it's almost the same thing. In either case, you're taking money out of the pockets of you know, the oil companies.
And is anybody talking about redirecting that money to the light rail systems that Don would like to see in places like Dallas, Oregon?
I haven't heard anything like that. But, you know, Senate Majority Leader or Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid just today discussed the idea of using the money that the Treasury would gain from repealing the tax incentives and the subsidies to pay for, you know, a fuel a rebate a suspension of the federal gas tax.
Okay, Don, thanks for the call.
Hey, thank you.
Good luck with the commute. And Peter Terzakian, let me ask you a question. How much of this price increase on gasoline in this country has been psychological? I mean, how much of it is a result of the sabers rattling about Iran, the concerns about the security of Nigeria's oil, that kind of thing?
Yeah, that's a very, very good question and difficult to quantify. In the case of Nigeria, there are actually physical barrels of oil that are now being restricted. About 20% of the country's output has been curtailed. In Iran, no production has been curtailed, but there is a general fear that were there to be military action, for example, in that part of the world, or were Iran to restrain their barrels of oil as a revenge for sanctions, then obviously the price would go a lot higher, so the market's tending to price that in. How much is it? I would say that if the Iranian situation was not brewing right now, if there was calm on the geopolitical front, the price of oil would probably be about $10 less, and the price of gasoline would probably be more closer to $2.25 to $2.30. Were you to take the Nigerian situation out of that, you can probably knock another $5 a barrel off of that, and then your gas price would be down to about $2.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, more about the rising cost of gasoline and what, if anything, we can do about it, plus civil liberties and comic books. That's all after the break. 800-989-8255 on either subject, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Later on in the program today, the government demands that all superheroes unmask and register. Comic books and civil liberties collide on the pages of Marvel Comics. But first, the rising cost of gas. Our guests are Jeff Tollefson. He's a reporter with Congressional Quarterly who covers energy. And also Peter Terzakian, who chief energy economist and a director of the ARC. Or is that ARC or ARC Financial Corporation?
ARC Financial.
ARC Financial. Okay. And he's with us from Calgary in Canada. And let's get another call on the line. Arthur is with us. Arthur calling from Brooklyn Park in Minnesota.
Hello.
Hi.
I've got a situation. I lived in Argentina. I actually do about 4 months a year.
Mm-hmm.
And the situation there was the gas is capped at $2 or 2 pesos per liter or around $3 a gallon. And last year, Shell Oil decided we don't need to go along with this. And they raised their prices to $2.30 per liter. And 2 days later, the President Kirchner came on and said, these people are trying to create inflation in our country. Don't buy from them.
Uh-huh.
And so in the end, 3 weeks later, Shell rescinded the price increase because their business dropped 70%.
In part, I suspect, because their prices were considerably higher than their competitors.
Yeah, everybody else stayed at 2 pesos per liter. But, you know, a couple of them went up for a couple of days, but back down right away when the president came on.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, you know, the country is more democratic, more socialistic, kind of. But actually, they've come out of their recession. Things are going well. And the artificial cap there is just a voluntary thing. But when Shell decided, and they have nice stations, you go in there and you can get your milk and your coffee, just like here, exactly the same.
Hmm.
But they decided that they had enough willpower where they could withstand it. But within 3 weeks, they backed down. And again, we don't have a cap on gasoline prices here.
No, we don't. And everybody charges within a few pennies here and there.
They're all in the same ballpark, and it's like almost like a monopoly that's unwritten. But in that country, they're also now doing the same thing with other products to try and control inflation because mm-hmm. when these prices go up, and it's the same here, it hurts the people mainly.
Mm-hmm.
Not the rich people, not the poor people because they don't have cars, but the people in between. And one other thing I want to tell you is that in that country, they have something called compressed natural gas. It costs the same right now. Actually, the cost of gasoline here and there is exactly the same where we are. And the compressed natural gas runs for one-third the cost of gasoline. Why don't we have that in the USA? You can tell me that.
Well, I can't, but maybe Peter Terzakian can tell us.
Yeah.
Okay. There's a couple of issues here that are important. Do you want me to tackle the first one on this gas cap? It's true the United States obviously doesn't have a gas cap like Argentina.
Right.
But what the United States also does not have is a national oil company sort of priding on the free market economy. There's only really three countries in the world of any size that don't have national oil companies, and those are the United States, Canada, and the United Kingdom. Most countries have national oil companies, and through that mechanism, they can cap. But I assure you that in the context of global prices, there's subsidization going on somewhere. Somebody is subsidizing those prices, and ultimately it ends up being the taxpayer where you don't see. In terms of natural gas, it's true. Actually, Argentina has cheap access to natural gas, so that is an alternative for them if you have a vehicle that can consume it. But here again, in North America, their natural gas is nowhere near as cheap as it is in Argentina. So even if we did have a lot of vehicles that consumed it, it would be almost on par with oil, depending on the season.
Let's talk now with Ivan. One last call on the subject. Ivan is with us from Everglades City in Florida.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm 63, and I was in business in the 70s when we had our first oil crisis. And a couple of weeks before Nixon asked the American people to respond, I was in Los Angeles, and people were driving on the freeway, probably very much like they do now, like maniacs. And I flew out there a few days after Nixon, who was not a charismatic, well-loved leader, had gone on TV and gave the American people a feel for how serious the crisis was.
I think you're talking about President Carter.
No, no, I'm talking about President Nixon.
Well,
see, there were two oil crises. The first one was President Nixon in the 70s,
mm-hmm.
The early or the mid 70s, 73 or 74.
Yeah.
And he, one of the things he asked for was for Americans to drive at 55, and you know, to curtail lighting at night and turn down thermostats.
Oh, okay, I'll take your point. And
okay, and I went back to L.A. a couple of days later, and it was amazing. I couldn't believe it. People were lined up across the freeway with big signs in their windows, drive 55,
mm-hmm.
and cars were lining up shoulder to shoulder, forcing everyone to drive at 55. And, you know, that showed me that with leadership, bold leadership, even when it's not from a charismatic, well-liked leader, people respond when it's explained how important it is.
Right.
And then given something specific they can do that will make a difference. And the difference between driving 85 and 55, that would cause an immediate big drop in the price of oil and gasoline.
Mm-hmm. All right. Peter, I hear you.
Yeah, no, the caller is absolutely right. Speed is also a primary determinant. The unfortunate thing is that, as I said, we've migrated out to the suburbs and the urban sprawl, so nobody wants to take longer to get home after work. That's one issue. But, you know, in my book, 1,000 Barrels a Second, I talk about the need for a rally cry from leadership. And we're starting to hear those rally cries in other nations of the world, like Sweden, who's saying, you know, we're going to get off oil by 2020. In Iceland, they've had a rally cry. And the caller's right. There were rally cries in the United States in the 1970s. President Bush has come forth with a good start by saying the nation's addicted to oil. I think that was a very bold move. But he's got to go further. He's got to say, you know, this is a matter of national urgency and get people to participate on the conservation side.
And let me turn to you, Jeff Tollefson, for that. Are we hearing proposals from the White House and Congress that are about addressing the next few months, really, about the tactics of gasoline prices? Or are we hearing some of those far-reaching calls, the political will that the caller was talking about from the 1970s?
Well, I mean, this is the big question. I mean, Congress is kind of in a bind. You know, what they really want to do is address prices right now. And yet most of the things that they can do to address prices are longer term, you know, whether it's, you know, bringing in increasing domestic supplies or
mm-hmm.
Or increasing fuel efficiency standards for vehicles. So, you know, Congress is trying to do things now. And there have been calls for conservation, but you can only go so far with those issues.
Jeff Tollefson, thanks very much for being with us. Jeff Tollefson is an energy reporter for Congressional Quarterly, and he joined us here in Studio 3A. Peter Terzakian, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks very much.
Peter Terzakian is chief energy economist and director of ARC Financial Corporation, author of 1,000 Barrels a Second, The Coming Oil Breakpoint, and the Challenges Facing an Energy-Dependent World. He joined us today from the studios of the CBC in Calgary. Next up, Civil War in the comic books.